We've already talked a little bit about slide 10, but I haven't quite said everything about it. Let's remember where we are. This is an ionic bond that is forming. And so I can't remember whether I've already given you the three major categories of chemical bonds that you need to know for this course. Did I give you those? Okay. Well, before I do, let me say that not all bonds are chemical bonds. What is it that makes a chemical bond a chemical bond? Well, any bond is some sort of attractive force. Bond means to bind together, right? A chemical bond is a bond that, when it forms, if it does, produces new stuff. And so that's what happens in chemical reactions. Remember that a chemical reaction involves conversion of something, some number of reactants, into some number of products. And those products are new stuff with different properties compared to the reactants. That happens because of formations of bonds, chemical bonds. And so that's how you know it's a chemical bond, if it's different stuff after it's formed. All right. Well, there's actually more than three, but there's more than two. I mean, but there's two overall really important chemical bonds we'll talk about in this course, which are ionic bonds, and that's what we started talking about already. That's what's shown in slide 10. The other major group is called covalent bonds, and we haven't talked about those yet, but we'll. So we have ionic bonds, covalent bonds. There are other bonds possible, but I'm not going to talk about them in this course. All right, now these are both chemical bonds, so if either one of these forms, you have a new substance by definition of being a chemical bond. Of the chemical bonds, though, ionic bonds, which are the ones we're in the middle of talking about, the sodium chloride example, those are the weakest of the chemical bonds. Not the weakest of all bonds, but the weakest of the chemical bonds. There are weaker bonds that aren't chemical, and we'll talk about those in a bit. An ionic bond forms because what keeps the two particles involved together is that they have oppositely charged, they are oppositely charged particles. So obviously the bond, ionic bond, is named for the fact that ions are involved. Remember that ions are charged, but there are two categories of ions. What are the categories? Cations and anions. And which one has the positive charge? Cations. And what sort of elements make cations? Metals, exactly. Because metals, being on the left side of the periodic table, have an outer shell that is more empty than full. So it's easier for them to get rid of a few number of electrons than it is for them to gain a greater number in that shell. Because if they just empty that outer shell, which is almost empty right now, that outer shell won't even be considered a shell if it doesn't have any electrons in it, right? And therefore, their new outer shell would be the next one down, which is already filled. That's what gives them stability. But nonmetals form anions because nonmetals, being toward the right edge, have an outer shell that's more full than empty. So it's easier for them to gain a small number of electrons than it is to lose a big number of electrons. That's the general scheme. And that's why if an ionic bond forms, it is specifically involving a metal ion and a nonmetal ion, a metal cation and a nonmetal anion. And the only thing that holds them together is the fact that once the electron or electrons get transferred to produce the two ions to begin with from the original neutral atoms, the only thing that holds them together is the fact that they are oppositely charged particles at that point, and oppositely charged particles attract each other. So the strength or the force of the bond for an ionic bond is the electrostatic attraction of oppositely charged particles. Is that all clear? All right, now, this explains why salt forms when you have both sodium and chlorine as reactants. Sodium wants to give up its only electron in its outer shell. That will make it stable because now its new outer shell is already full, the second level. And chlorine will gladly take on that electron because it has an almost full outer shell, and that extra electron will fill it. So the sodium atom becomes a sodium ion with a positive one charge because now it has one fewer electron to counteract the positive charges of its protons in the nucleus. And the chlorine becomes a chloride ion. It's a slight name change for the nonmetals. Chloride ion, which is negatively charged because it has still has the same number of protons as it had, but now it has one additional negative electron. Adds up to negative one. That's what holds them together. All right, that's an ionic bond that's forming, but as far as substance is concerned, what's happening is that you're making a compound, right? This, an ionic bond is always going to make a compound. What is a compound? It's not enough to say one or two or more atoms. It's true that there's two or more atoms, but it's, that's also true of some things that aren't compounds. What's that?
A compound is a new substance formed by two or more atoms of different varieties.
What do you want to use instead of variety?
Elements,
right. A compound involves two or more elements. We already saw it in one of the versions of a chemical reaction that I showed you before involving oxygen and hydrogen becoming water. Remember that one? A hydrogen molecule involves two atoms, but they're both hydrogens, so that's not a compound. That's an element, a molecule of the element hydrogen, and similarly with oxygen. But the water that results is a compound. Okay. Well, here we have a compound forming as well because there's two different elements making it up. And that's always going to be the case for an ionic compound because, if you haven't noticed it already, an ionic compound can only form between two different things, right? They have to be oppositely charged. They're not going to be the same kind of ion because two ions of the same element are going to have the same charge and they're going to repel each other, not attract each other. Does that make sense to you? Okay, so ionic bonds always form compounds, and we call those ionic compounds as one of their names in as a category, but you can also call them salts. Salts are compounds formed by ionic bonds. Salts is another name for ionic compounds. And like I said, when we first talked about the reaction we were studying, which is this reaction, what we usually mean when we simply say salt in everyday language is just one of many, many salts, one of many, many ionic compounds. Sodium chloride is table salt, but there's a hell of a lot of others. All you have to do is get a metal ion and a nonmetal ion together, you make a salt. Okay. Now, in 11, this same reaction, the same formation of ionic bonds is being shown here, but this illustrates an important point. If I were to ask people, and you qualify as people, so I'll just ask you, whether salts, or like table salt as one salt, is it made out of molecules, what would your answer be? Yeah, I think most people would say yes, but it's not true. Molecule properly is used for covalent structures, not for ionic bonded structures. And that's not just because we want it to be that way. There's a fundamental difference between the two. That's what's illustrated by this picture. We studied this in the previous slide from the viewpoint of just one sodium atom and one chlorine atom becoming ions and attracting each other. That can happen, of course, if that's all you have. But usually there are quadrillions and quadrillions of each of the types of atoms. That's still not even enough to see because they're so small. So it's not just one atom of each type. Instead, you have a population of metal atoms and a population of non-metal atoms that become ionized. And when you think about just a single atom of sodium losing its electron to become positively charged, it's not positively charged in just one direction of its shape, on one of its sides, in other words. It's positive wherever you look at it, from any direction. Therefore, it can attract a negatively charged particle from all of its sides. And similarly, but oppositely, for the chloride ion. It's positive in all directions, it's negative in all directions, and it will attract a positive from everywhere. And that's why when sodium and chlorine react to form sodium chloride, it's not just exactly one sodium atom or ion and one chloride ion. The yellow ones here are the sodium ions. If there are a lot of chloride ions, which there almost always are, then that single sodium, positively charged sodium ion will attract negatively charged green chloride ions in all directions around itself. And similarly for the green attracting the yellow. So they don't form a predefined size chunk. And that's what a molecule is, as we'll see once I continue with molecules. This is not a molecule. A molecule does have a predefined size. Like an oxygen molecule is not some number of oxygen atoms, it's exactly two oxygen atoms. That doesn't happen with salts, though. Salts form crystals that are arbitrarily as big as you want. And real salt, real sodium chloride that gets mined for sale as table salt, can be a single chunk bigger than this building. It just depends on how many ions you have. So there is no upper limit to how big a piece of salt can be. There is a lower limit, though. And that lower limit we don't call a molecule. We call it a formula unit. So the formula unit for sodium chloride would be exactly one sodium ion and exactly one chloride ion. You have to have at least that, or you don't have sodium chloride, right? So that's the smallest piece. There is no limit to the biggest piece, though. Okay, ionic bonds are strong enough to hold things together to make new stuff, but they are not nearly as strong as this second major category of chemical bonds, which are the covalent bonds. And let me just, since I'm getting to this word, talk about part of the word itself, which is the valent part. I need to give you some more definitions. There is a word in chemistry called valence, but there's different ways that this can be used, which can be confusing. So I want to give you these different ways and make sure you understand the difference. One way that we use this word is to describe what are called valence electrons. A valence electron is simply any electron that is in the atom's outermost shell. So not necessarily all of the electrons in an atom are valence electrons, right? For hydrogen, its only electron is a valence electron because it's in its outer shell. But you know, when you, for sodium, the one we're looking at, for instance, it's has atoms. I mean, it has electrons in the first shell, in the second shell, and then it also has one in the third shell. So it has one valence electron. The other ones are non-valence electrons. They're deeper in toward the nucleus. The reason why we care so much about valence electrons, to give them their own name, is that when chemistry happens, it requires two atoms at least getting together, right? Substances come together, the reactants have to come into contact with each other. And as I said, really what happens is just a rearrangement of particles, right? But think about an atom encountering another atom. What is it that actually comes into contact? Not the nuclei. They're in the core of these things. What come into contact are the outermost parts of each of the two atoms involved, which are the electron clouds, and specifically the outermost part, or the outermost shell of that electron cloud. That's why we care about valence electrons. They're the ones that are involved in chemical reactions. Those are the ones that get rearranged, like you saw in the ionic compound, right? It was the outermost electron that got transferred from sodium to chlorine. That's one use of the word valence. We also can refer to an atom's valence shell, which is simply the outermost shell of the atom that contains at least one electron. If it's empty, we don't even consider it. It's there, but it's just space. The valence shell is the outermost one that's non-empty. And then a third use of this same word is just the word by itself. We talk about an atom's valence. And this is particularly important for nonmetals. Where are the nonmetals? So you mean argon, krypton, yeah, not the noble gases, but just to the left of that, and in a triangle toward the upper right hand corner, excluding that right edge. Those are the nonmetals. And we often talk about any of those nonmetals' valence. The valence of an atom is how many additional electrons that atom does not have yet it would take to fill its valence shell or subshell, really, but shell's good enough for you to think about. Now, hydrogen is what kind of element?
Non-metal.
It's also a nonmetal, correct, even though it's over here by itself. What is the valence shell of hydrogen? Level 1, exactly, shell 1. They are numbered, the shells are numbered, which is why it's in the first period. Periods correspond to shells. How many valence electrons does hydrogen have? One, its only electron. What is the valence of hydrogen?
Two.
No. The first shell, which is the valence shell of hydrogen, has a maximum capacity of 2 electrons, right? But I just told you that the valence is how many more electrons it would take to fill that shell. Since the first shell is filled by 2, and hydrogen already has 1 valence electron, then its valence is 2 minus 1, which is also 1. So its valence is just coincidentally the same as the number of valence electrons it has. That's just coincidence, though, right? Look at oxygen. Oxygen is oxygen for only one reason, as we've said. It's because it has exactly 8 protons. So it has 8 electrons, though, as well. 2 of them fill up the first shell. The other 6 are in the second shell, which is why oxygen's in the second period. The second shell has a maximum capacity of how many electrons? 8, because it has how many orbitals?
4.
That's why it is 8, because each individual orbital can hold a maximum of 2. So it has how many valence electrons, oxygen? No. 6 valence electrons, but its valence is 2, right? Because it has a valence shell that can hold 8, and therefore has room for 2 more. That's what the valence always is, how many more it takes to fill it. But practically speaking, on the periodic table, notice that oxygen is 2 steps away from the right edge that all of these atoms are seeking the stability of. So that's how you can practically and quickly think of the valence for a nonmetal. How many steps away from the right edge it is. So fluorine has a valence of 1. 1 step away from the right edge, and so on. Well, hydrogen is also 1 step away from the edge. It's way over here on the left, but there's only 2 groups in the first period, right? So it's also 1 step away. That's because it's 1 away from 2. 2 is the magic number for period 1, 8 for the next one, for the next period. Okay, those are the uses of the word valence. Is there any question on the difference between the 3 ways the word is used? All right, well, covalent comes from the fact that co means share. And so a covalent bond is one in which there's not a permanent transfer of an electron or some number of electrons like there is in an ionic bond. Instead, there is a continuous sharing of one or more pairs of electrons. Not one or more electrons, one or more pairs of electrons. Which should make sense when you think about sharing. That's why it's pairs of electrons, because each of them needs to share one or more with the other. So if they're both sharing, then the overall amount of electrons that are being shared is in pairs. Okay? If you think about these as having feelings and preferences, these 2 hydrogen atoms that we look at here each have a valence of 1, as we just talked about. They have 1 valence electron, but they also happen to have a valence of 1. And so one taking on an additional electron will make the hydrogen happy, like helium. The same exact thing is true for the other hydrogen, right? And that's why it's not going to be a transfer of an electron from one hydrogen to the other. It would please one of the hydrogens, but it would piss off the other one. So they basically strike a deal and say, I will share, each one says, I will share mine with you if you also share yours with me. And that way we will both, even though there's only 2 overall electrons, we'll both get credit for both of those shared electrons. And it will get the stability of helium because each of us will have 2 electrons going around our nucleus. It's not a transfer, though, because that shared pair of electrons do not spend all of the time around one nucleus or the other. They spend some time around each of the 2 nuclei. That's illustrated by the merging of the yellow cloud here. Okay, so we don't really know specifically where the electrons are, but that pair of electrons that's being shared, one from each of the 2 hydrogen nuclei, is spending time around each of the 2 nuclei. And that is what keeps them together. Well, that not only keeps them together, it keeps them together much more strongly than the force of electrostatic attraction between oppositely charged ions does in an ionic bond. They're both chemical bonds, so you have a new thing, a new structure with its own properties, but covalent bonds are much, much stronger and therefore harder to break. I'll explain why that's important later on, but keep it in mind. All right, anyway, that's why they're called covalent. They're sharing valence electrons. If we look at 13, or is it 13? Damn, that is 13, right? We can see this represented with what are called electron dot diagrams. Okay, now an electron dot diagram has a proper way to be written. You start any electron dot diagram with writing the element's symbol down. The element's symbol represents the nucleus. But by using the symbol, you know what kind of atom it is. All right, so you start with an H. That's the proton that's in the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. An important thing to understand about electron dot diagrams is that we don't necessarily use all of an atom's electrons in the symbol or in the diagram. Only valence electrons are shown as dots in the diagram. We don't care about the deeper ones, if there are any deeper ones, because they're shielded. They're not going to take place, they're not going to take part in rearrangement if a covalent bond forms. Well, for hydrogen, it only has one electron, so it is a valence electron, and it doesn't matter what side of this atom you put the dot on, it just represents its valence electron. So that's by itself is the electron dot diagram for hydrogen. Oxygen, though, of course, you don't start with an H, you start with an O. That's the nucleus for oxygen. And as we were saying, oxygen has 8 total electrons, but only 6 of them are valence electrons. So you don't put 8 dots on this one, you put 6. You do it a specific way, though. The 6 valence electrons of oxygen are in which shell? Second shell, which contains how many subshells? No. 2 subshells. What are they called? The S subshell and the P subshell. Okay, now you can go to where 4 is the correct answer. How many total orbitals? 4. And so that's why 4 sides of the oxygen are used in the diagram, because there's 4 orbitals. Now you have 6 electrons for oxygen, 6 valence electrons that you need to list dot by dot. But you do this in a way so that you're not filling any orbital until you have to. So first you spread your electrons out into separate orbitals until you run out of orbitals. That's 4 of them. Now you have 2 more, so that means you're going to have to fill 2 of these orbitals, and it doesn't matter which ones you put the pairs on. I'll just do it that way. All right? This diagram shows you why oxygen has a valence of 2. Because it can take 2 more electrons to fill that shell, right? And so this is another way of thinking about a nonmetal's valence, other than to compute the number. You can also think of it as being the number of covalent bonds it's going to have to make in order to be satisfied like the right edge. We say that it will satisfy its valence if it's able to fill these 2 remaining spots. Okay, well, when a covalent bond forms, what's called a single covalent bond, which we just saw in hydrogen's example, a single covalent bond is a sharing of one pair, 2 overall electrons, right? Because each of the participants is sharing an electron. That's one pair. But that means each of the participants gets credit for an additional electron, for a single covalent bond. Well, two participants can make a deal to share two from each atom as well. That's called a double covalent bond. It's two pairs, four overall. And the valence of oxygen being two tells you oxygen needs to form two covalent bonds, or a double covalent bond, which counts as two covalent bonds. That's exactly what's happening here with these two oxygens. When they get together, it's these four electrons that are being shared, but that's two pairs. And each participating oxygen gets credit for an additional two electrons. That's what satisfies its valence. There's even such a thing as a triple covalent bond. If you draw the electron dot diagram of nitrogen, starting with its symbol, which is N, notice where it is, just to the left of oxygen. So it has how many valence electrons?
3.
No. It has five valence electrons. What is its valence?
3.
That is 3. You know that it has five valence electrons because it has 7 overall. The two that fill up the lower shell are not going to be shown here. They're not valence electrons. So you do the same thing. You start with 4 dots. You only have one more to fill up just one of the four orbitals, right? So it has 3 unsatisfied orbitals. That's why it has a valence of 3. And that's why it has to form a total of 3 covalent bonds. All right? Now, when we talk about higher than single covalent bonds, there's two ways it can happen. An atom with a valence of 2 has to form 2 covalent bonds to be satisfied. But it can do that by forming 2 single covalent bonds with each of 2 other atoms. Or it can form 1 double covalent bond, which counts as 2 covalent bonds in one. That's what happens with an oxygen molecule. Similarly, nitrogen has to form 3 overall covalent bonds, but it can do that by forming 3 separate covalent bonds, single. It can form 1 double and 1 single, which adds up to 3. Or it can form the strongest possible chemical bond, which is a triple covalent bond. You know, 2 nitrogens together, going to be in the same boat. So these ones, and these ones are all going to be shared. And you would write that as N triple bar N for short. Where you have shared electrons as a pair of dots in this scheme, you can also just use a bar to represent one pair of shared electrons. Each bar counts as a single covalent bond, or counts as a covalent bond. Now, this has profound biological implications, by the way, this fact that nitrogen gas forms as N2 with a triple bond between it. Nitrogen, remember, is one of those big 4 elements that all organisms that have ever existed have to have. You can't have proteins or nucleic acids without nitrogen. Therefore, no organisms without oxygen or without nitrogen. Ironically, we organisms that live in the atmosphere as our fluid rather than as opposed to water are surrounded by a hell of a lot of nitrogen. Air is a mixture of gases, but 3/4 of it, roughly, is pure nitrogen. Nitrogen molecules. And so we cannot live without nitrogen, but almost no organisms in the world are able to use that rich source of nitrogen directly. There's only a few species of bacteria that have the ability to break this extraordinarily strong triple bond of nitrogen to transform it chemically into other nitrogen-containing compounds. Things that the rest of the world can use. So this is just one reason why we cannot exist without bacteria, and specific bacteria. Even plants can't do it. They can feed themselves, but they have to have something else give their nitrogen to them. Okay, so those are covalent bonds, very much stronger than ionic. We see some more covalent bonds in 14. This is just different ways of representing them. You can see the bar notation that I was talking about, which just a single bar is the same as two dots. And it just it's easier to see as a bond when you use the bar, but just remember it. One bar is really two electrons. A double bar is therefore four electrons. And on the bottom we have a carbon-containing compound, methane, which, notice, involves four bonds with carbon. Well, carbon, as you look, someone circled it on the periodic table. It has a valence of four because it is four steps away from the edge, right? It has four valence electrons, and it can hold eight, so its valence is four. And that makes carbon really special, so special to life that we're going to dedicate an entire chapter to it coming up next, or not next, but two chapters from now. The space-filling models are nice to look at, but they don't really give you as much information, really, as the others. Okay, 15. What kind of... before we talk about this, let me just explicitly say that when covalent bonds are formed, the structure that results is a properly called a molecule. That's different from a salt in a couple ways. One is that covalent bonds form between nonmetals. Okay, so remember, for a salt or an ionic compound, you have to have a metal and a nonmetal. Not two metals, not two nonmetals, a metal and a nonmetal for ionic compounds. For covalent bonds to form, you have to have a nonmetal and a nonmetal. So that brings up another difference right away compared to salts. When I say a nonmetal, that means it can be two of the same nonmetal, right? Doesn't have to be two different elements. An oxygen molecule is not a compound, but it's a different thing compared to an oxygen atom, right? It's two oxygen atoms bonded together covalently, and we call that a molecule because the bond is a covalent bond. But this also brings up the difference compared to a formula unit. When an oxygen molecule forms, both of the oxygens become completely satisfied. And they therefore don't want to do sharing with anyone else. Right? That's why that piece is done. That piece of oxygen, once a molecule forms, is done. It's not going to keep growing indefinitely like a salt would, a salt crystal. Now, you can have a hell of a lot of oxygen molecules in a sample, even a tiny sample, but they're all individually, each molecule is satisfied, and they're just bouncing off of each other. They're not bonding together like salts, the ions in a salt would. So molecules are a predefined size, that's what I'm saying. Okay, that's the two major categories of chemical bonds. But one of the second one that we've been talking about, covalent as a category, can be subdivided. So we're going to talk about two different kinds of covalent bonds. And those two categories are nonpolar covalent bonds. And from that word, you can probably guess the other, polar covalent bonds. All right, they're both covalent bonds, but there is a distinction, obviously, that the words indicate. What has to be true for any bond to be covalent to begin with? Right, there has to be a sharing. Also, it has to be between nonmetals. Elements, right? But there has to be a sharing, otherwise it's not covalent. Well, you might have been involved in sharing in your life as a human, and you might know already that sharing doesn't have to be equal, right? One of the participants might be hogging whatever is being shared. Like if you share a car and say, I'll take it 3 days a week, I'll take it 4 days a week, you can have it 3 days a week. That's an unequal sharing. Same is true for electrons that are shared by nonmetal atoms in covalent bonds. And that's the distinction between polar covalent bonds and nonpolar covalent bonds. A nonpolar covalent bond is a covalent bond in which the sharing of however many pairs of electrons are involved is equal sharing. And oxygen's a good example of that, and so is hydrogen. A hydrogen molecule is made up of two hydrogen atoms that are equally sharing one pair of electrons. An oxygen molecule is a nonpolar, is formed by a nonpolar covalent bond that is an equal sharing of two pairs of electrons by those oxygen atoms. Well, what I mean by equal sharing is that the electrons, wherever they are at any given moment, we don't know, but the electrons that are being shared by the two species, the two participants, those electrons are spending the same amount of time around each of the two electron nuclei. Okay? That's not always the case, though. If there is unequal sharing, then that means one of the two participating nonmetal atoms is hogging the shared pair of electrons, and therefore those electrons are spending more time around that nucleus than they are around the other nucleus. They're still spending time around both, otherwise it wouldn't be a covalent bond. But they're spending more time around one than the other. And so that brings up the question of why this would happen. Why would one participant allow this to happen? Well, they don't have any say in the matter, really. This has to do with something that is called the electronegativity, which any given element has. Any given element has all kinds of different properties that we can talk, like melting point and blah, blah, blah. Electronegativity is a property of elements. And at least roughly speaking, electronegativity is the tendency for an atom to attract electrons to itself. And that's not equal for all elements. Some kinds of atoms attract electrons more strongly than others do. And so numerically, those ones that have a stronger attraction for electrons, numerically they have a higher electronegativity value. All right? It's not a perfect trend on the periodic table, but if you ignore the noble gases, because they don't want any more electrons. Ignoring the noble gases, if you look at the rest of the table, and starting from the lower left, the electronegativities are low here, and they get higher as you go up and to the right. The element with the highest electronegativity value is fluorine. It very strongly attracts electrons to itself. Notice that oxygen, though, is right next door, so it's also very high compared to hydrogen, for instance. Well, hydrogen and oxygen are both involved in this molecule. This is water that we're looking at. A single water molecule, and it's a molecule because it's formed by covalent bonds, Therefore, since it's two or more different elements that are involved, we can call the whole thing not only a molecule, but we can call it a covalent compound. It involves oxygen and hydrogen, and they have pretty drastically different electronegativity values. Oxygen wants those electrons more than hydrogen does, in a sense. So it's going to hog them in the sharing deal. That's what's represented by the yellow arrow in each of the two bonds. There's two separate single covalent bonds here. Notice, by the way, that oxygen has to be making two total bonds because its valence is two. And that's why it's making a bond with two separate hydrogens. So its total bonds add up to two. But each bond is represented by an arrow, and the directionality of the arrow indicates that oxygen is hogging that shared pair. That shared pair between this oxygen and this hydrogen is spending more time around oxygen than it is around the hydrogen nucleus. Same is true for the other bond. Electrons are negatively charged, of course. So that means if electrons spend more time around this end of the molecule, the oxygen end, than they do around the hydrogen ends, that's going to give the oxygen end a slight charge. Not a full charge like an ion would have, because those electrons are not always there. But if they're there more often than not, that's going to make the oxygen end slightly negative. And this lowercase Greek delta, the uppercase is an equilateral triangle. The lowercase is this D-looking thing, and it's the Greek D. This delta minus means a partial, not a full, negative charge. And similarly, since the hydrogen end is not going to have those electrons around as often, that's going to make the hydrogen end slightly positive. Same for the other hydrogen. Now, overall, the molecule doesn't have any charge, because overall, the molecule has the same number of protons and electrons. But this is a polar molecule because it's made up of bonds that are themselves polar. Okay, so it's the bonds that really start out being called either polar or nonpolar. And then you can call the overall molecule either polar or nonpolar depending on what kinds of bonds are involved. This fact that water is polar and its bonds are polar can't really be overstressed. I mean, the importance of that can't be overstressed. We wouldn't exist if this weren't true. No organisms would exist. And it's the fact that water is polar is really the underlying reason why water has quite a few special characteristics that have allowed for life to evolve. We're going to have a whole chapter dedicated to water because of that. But I'm just introducing the notion of polar molecules right now. Okay? Now, an oxygen molecule, notice, is made of two oxygen atoms. Each oxygen has a very high electronegativity, but they're equally greedy, exactly equally greedy, because they're the same element. And therefore, no one wins out. It's like pulling equally strong on a tug-of-war rope. No one wins, right? And therefore, an oxygen molecule is nonpolar. Because it's exactly equal electronegativities, the shared two pairs, in this case, spend equal amount of time around each of the two. And there's no partially positive and partially negative end. Well, when you, once again, it's not one molecule that matters here, or that you have in reality. It's quadrillions and quadrillions of molecules. And if you have quadrillions and quadrillions of oxygen molecules, since they are nonpolar, they're just bouncing off of each other. They're not being attracted to each other because they don't have any partial charges. but you get quadrillions and quadrillions of water molecules together, they're not simply bouncing off of each other. When they get close to each other, they are affected by their partial charges on different ends of the molecules. And they start to swivel in such a way that the partially positive end of one will be attracted to the partially negative end of the other. And that gives a population of water molecules different properties. And it gives it a degree of order that a population of nonpolar molecules would have. We can see that in 16, not with two water molecules, which would work, but in this case with two polar molecules. One's water on top, the other is ammonia. It is polar. Ammonia is polar for the same reason. The electronegativity of nitrogen is quite a bit higher than the electronegativity of hydrogen. So each of these three bonds is not only covalent, but polar covalent, because it's unequal sharing. And the electrons spend more time around the nitrogen end, making it negative. So when these two come into contact, it's not just a random collision. It's like getting two magnets close to each other, only it's not magnetic. It's an analogy, though. When you get two magnets close together, before they even make contact, you can tell that there's a force of attraction between them. And they will swivel in such a way that the negatives, the partial negative and partial positives, will get close to each other. That is another kind of bond. And as you see, we call it a hydrogen bond, not because hydrogen has to be involved, it just usually is because there's so many hydrogens. But a hydrogen bond is a bond that forms between two nonpolar molecules. Polar molecules. This, though, is the first bond that I've actually given as an example of something that a bond that is not chemical. A hydrogen bond is not a chemical bond. These two things remain water and ammonia. They don't form new stuff. That's why it's not a chemical bond. But it's a bond, it's a force of attraction, and therefore it's greater than zero. Like zero would be for two oxygen atoms being nonpolar and coming together. All right? Hydrogen bond. 17. In this figure, we see why molecules have the shapes that they do. Well, for an oxygen molecule, there's really only one shape it could have, right? Because you have two atoms of oxygen coming together. There's doesn't matter which way they're arranged, it's going to be a linear arrangement. Water, though, notice whenever you see this space-filling model, is not arranged as symmetrically as it could. It's not oxygen and hydrogen on one side and hydrogen exactly on the opposite side, as you might think would be the case. Why is it bent like this? Well, that's because of the fact that oxygen has valence electrons in shell 2, right? Shell 2 has how many orbitals?
Four.
The four orbitals, which contain electrons, right? And orbitals, since they contain electrons, which are all negatively charged, are going to repel each other because they're like charges. Well, in space, if you have four things that are all trying to repel each other, but they're all connected to a center, the way that you can maximally space those out is to form a tetrahedron, with each orbital in one of the corners of the tetrahedron. For you gaming nerds, a tetrahedron is the four-sided die. It has four corners on it. So oxygen is in the middle, and the orbitals around that oxygen nucleus are on these corners, maximally spaced out from each other. Well, look at oxygen's electron dot diagram. Two of those four orbitals are full already. They're not going to be involved in any sharing, but they are occupying two of these corners. The other two are the ones that are shared with hydrogen to form a water molecule. And that's why they're at that specific angle. It's specifically the angle between these two corners on a tetrahedron. Similarly, you have the same tetrahedron for methane, which is the simplest hydrocarbon, one carbon and four hydrogens. Carbon's in the middle of that four-sided die, and each of the four hydrogens is at the four corners. That explains its geometry. Or hopefully it explains it. Tell me if it doesn't. This brings us to 18. And 18 is the first time being introduced in this course to the notion of a signal, a chemical signal. A chemical signal is a chemical, but the reason it's a signal is that it causes something to happen in a cell that would not happen if the signal were not present. Okay, so signals cause things to happen. And chemical signals are simply chemicals that do that. Well, one really important thing to know about signals, or chemical signals, is that no chemical signal will have any effect at all unless and until that chemical signal binds to a protein called a receptor. The purple things here are protein receptors. They are receptors made out of protein. And the multicolored things are the signals themselves. This is the first example of many that we'll visit in this class of a ligand. Chemical signals are ligands, but there's other kinds of ligands. Ligand is a very general term. The L-I-G part of the word is the same as in ligature or ligate, which means to tie. So a ligand is named because it is some particle that binds to something else. That's by nature what chemical signals are. They're worthless unless they bind to something that is able to receive them. And the thing that's able to receive them, based on their shape, the proper shape, kind of like a key in a lock, is a receptor, which is a protein. All right, now, on the left, we have endorphin, which is an example of an endogenous chemical signal. Endogenous means create within, created within. An endogenous signal is one that our body makes naturally. And it's pretty complex molecule, as you see here, but really, the only part that matters, because it's the only part that fits into a receptor, if the receptor is there, to have any effect, is this part that's in the box. On the right, we have an exogenous signal, meaning that we don't make it in our bodies. It has to be put into our bodies. Another name for an exogenous signal is a drug. That's what morphine is here. Morphine's pretty much different in overall molecular structure compared to endorphin. It's much simpler, as you see overall, but it has this part of it that is very similar to the business end of endorphin. So morphine also fits into the same kind of receptor, and the response in the cell will therefore be the same as if endorphin bound instead. All right. That is where I need to stop. Am I done? Yeah, perfect timing. I'll see you downstairs.